Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll. And hey, you know what last Friday was? July 6th, to be exact. It was 36 years ago on July 6th, 1982, that Metallica recorded the No Life to Leather demo at a little studio in Tustin, California called Chateau East Studio. Yeah, one of the most famous bands in rock and roll history released their very first little EP 36 years ago. So Tustin, California is in Orange County, California, not far from Disneyland. And what's so special about this demo is that it features original Metallica bassist Ron McGovney. And what's so special about tonight's Talk is Jericho is it features original Metallica bassist Ron McGovney. No Life to Leather featured Hit the Lights, The Mechanics, Motor Breath, Seek and Destroy, Metal Militia, Jump in the Fire, and of course, Phantom Lord. And to mark this killer anniversary, once again, I've got the original OG Metallica bass player Ron McGovney on the show today. He was in Metallica with James and Lars and Dave Mustaine all the way back in 1982. And Ron's got some incredible stories about how Metallica got started, from how he and James Hetfield met and became friends in junior high, to starting up their own bands in Ron's parents' garage, to meeting Lars Ulrich, to Dave Mustaine joining his guitar player. He's got stories about their first gigs, right down to how Ron got them on the bill at the Whiskey A Go-Go with Saxon. It was Metallica's second show ever. Ron's also talking about being replaced in Metallica by the amazing Cliff Burton, how that all really went down and why Ron wasn't at all surprised when it happened. He's a great guy. He's a nice guy. Ron McGovney coming up next, and also coming up very soon is Fozzy's summer tour. We're starting Thursday, tomorrow, July 12th at the Rock USA Festival in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And we're doing a bunch of other festivals dates before the official Judas Rising tour gets started up again in August with Adelita's Way, The Stir, and Stone Broken joining us this time around. FozzyRock.com for all ticket information and all VIP meet and greet information. We got one of the greatest meet and greets you're ever going to see. We do a mini set for you, a little concert for you VIPers. We take pictures, we sign stuff, we hang out. So come see us before the show at one of the best VIP meet and greets of the business. Go to FozzyRock.com for all that information. And like I say, we're doing a little round of festivals this week, starting on the 12th in Oshkosh. Then on the 13th, we go to the Cadott Rock Festival in Cadott, Wisconsin. 14th is the Peoria Riverfront in Peoria, Illinois. 15th, Belvedere, Illinois at the Apollo Theater. Then we pack it up and head over the pond to Europe, starting at the Pheasant Festival in Hungary on July 26th. And we're going to Prague, the Rock of Ages Festival, Zurich, Rock Planet in Italy, Slovenia, Wacken in Germany, Berlin, Bochum, Aschaffenburg, Spain, Alcatraz Festival in Belgium. Then we finish it up at Bloodstock in England. Then we come back to the States for the start of the Judas Rising Tour Friday, August 24th in Atlanta, Georgia at Smith's Old Bar. We're hitting Huntsville, Clarksville, Little Rock, Joliet, Omaha, Des Moines, Minneapolis, Fargo, St. Louis, Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, Columbus, Cincinnati, Louisville, Charlotte, Jacksonville, North Carolina, Huntington, Greenville, South Carolina, Savannah, Lake Buena Vista at the House of Blues, Tampa, Florida, and Fort Lauderdale, Florida. All that information, once again, on FozzyRock.com. And we're also doing the Rock Allegiance show in Camden, New Jersey, October 6th. So go check that out and stay with us here as we check out the early Metallica and original Metallica bass player Ron McGovney right here on Talk is Jericho. All right, so we're here in Winston-Salem on the back of the bus. And I'm here with Ron McGovney, who I met at the Metallica show in Atlanta. And of course, you are the original bass player from Metallica. Do you go see the band quite a bit? It was cool to see you there.
Whenever they come around, you know, they'll call me and, you know, tell me what's going on. And, you know, I'll go see them and stuff. But, you know, it's not like it was back in the 80s, you know, when we used to, you know, go hang out and drink and party. You know, it's more of a family, you know, it's a family vibe now, you know. But
that is kind of how it is now, like you said, just the way they tour. Yeah. You know, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, but right, they're also very like Metallica family oriented, and obviously you're a part of that, so yeah, it's cool that they still kind of include you in those things.
Well, if you want to look at Metallica as a family, if you ever seen the Chevy Chase vacation movies, I'm the cousin Eddie of Metallica. You know, I kind of show up. It's like, oh no, oh yeah, here he is. You know, yeah. Well, not really like that, yeah, but it's just, you know, I kind of feel that way sometimes. You know, people come up and meet me. Oh, you're the guy before Cliff, right? Yeah, you know. So it's kind of like that. But
in a way, it's almost like Pete Best with the Beatles.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. That's kind of like the guy who was in the band.
Yeah, but I think my role back then was a lot easier than, let's say, Jason or Rob having to live up to Cliff. Now, you know, there's, I mean, Jason went through that whole thing. Rob goes through it all the time. And I never had to have that because, you know, I was before that. But
you were replaced by Cliff Burton.
Right.
Which is nothing, no shame in that.
But that was not, I mean, my role in Metallica was never to be the full-time, I mean, full-time, yes, but, I mean, long-term bass player. Because James and I were, you know, we were friends from junior high school, and, you know, we had a band after, you know, after we graduated, and, you know, we started in my garage, and...
What was it called?
It was called Leather Charm. Mm. And we played a lot of covers. We played Iron Maiden covers. We played Hollywood Tease by the band Girl from Phil Collin.
Mm-hmm.
That band...
Which is funny to think of Hetfield playing a girl song.
Oh, yeah. We played Slick Black Cadillac from the original Quiet Riot. Just a lot. And we had, I mean, we're kind of glam. It was just kind of funny. If you look at the original, the very first Metallica pictures, James is still wearing his Leather Charm stuff with the little, you know, wristband and the tiger stripe shirt and stuff like that. He never wants to look at that stuff, but
right.
You know.
Well, let's talk about this. So this is in California. Was it Downey or?
Yeah, it was in James and I went to high school and junior high school in Downey.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in a city next door called Norwalk, but I did go to Downey schools. So we started the band in. My parents had four houses all in the same property, and what happened was there was a freeway that was going to take our houses and our houses were going to be demolished. So once they started moving everyone out, I asked my mom, I said, well, can we just have the middle house just to practice, you know, band stuff? She said, you guys can live there until they kick us out, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So we took the garage and we turned it into, quote unquote, the studio. And that's where we started Leather Charm.
How did you meet James?
Junior high school. You know?
So what was it? You just a kid in your class?
He's just a kid in the class. But, you know, I didn't really know him that well in junior high school. But when we transitioned from junior high to high school, kind of the kids from the junior highs, they kind of know each other, and we just kind of everybody left, and we were just kind of the guys there that we all kind of knew each other,
right?
You know, so it was James and a few other friends and stuff, and that would be this fall of 1977.
Wow, this is a long time.
So you're looking 40 years ago here at this point. But I had Elvis Presley had just died over the summer, and I had a big Elvis sticker on my notebook, and he just made fun of that left and right. You know, he's like, "Hey, here's the guy with the Elvis sticker," you know. And so, but I'm like, "Yeah, he's had Aerosmith or whatever on his peachy," and I was like, "Yeah, well, Aerosmith sucks." And we just go back and forth, but you know, we both like music. You know, we just kind of, you know. We bonded in that.
What was he like? Was he a shy kid or was he?
Oh yeah, I mean he was real shy. Never the James Hetfield that people know now. You would never think it was the same guy.
Hmm.
Very shy, withdrawn. But he was a music kid. I mean he knew music and you could talk to him about anything in music, and he would talk about this band, that band, and I would bring up this band, or because I was more into like singer-songwriters like Jim Croce and Neil Young and things like that. And he'd be like, "No, man, you got to listen to UFO, and you know, you got to listen to Scorpions and this." I'm like, "Okay." So he kind of got me into the heavier, you know, stuff like that.
Were you playing at that point in time?
I had when I was in high school, I got a Les Paul. And I had taken guitar lessons when I was about 12 to like 14, so kind of classical stuff. So I was playing guitar. And so James was in a cover band called Obsession when we were in high school. And they played like Communication Breakdown, Heaven and Hell, you know, just the standard covers of the day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "You know, I'm tired of doing this. I want to do my own thing. I want to write my own music." You know, he said, "I already play guitar. Why don't you play bass?" I'm like, "Bass? What? Huh? I don't know anything about playing bass. He's like, well, let's just go down to the music center. Tell Downey Music Center was downtown Downey. So we went down there and I picked it up. I'm like, I don't know what the hell to do with this, you know, really. Because I never really paid attention to bass players. I kind of always looked at the guitar player and never really listened as a bass player. So he said, well, here, we'll just do this. So we practiced in my room for a while. And so he kind of just taught me, you know, what to do and stuff. And that's how we kind of got our...
Did you have a feel for it? I mean,
it kind of never really came to me, to tell you the truth. Because I always thought of guitar players. I always thought of Michael Schenker, you know, and Matthias Jabs. And I was thinking, you know, lead guitar players. I was thinking Rudolf Schenker. If you listen to someone like Rush or something, you know, they're following the drums, you know. And I always wanted to follow the guitar player, you know. And that's not, I mean, unless you're in AC/DC or something, that's really not, you know, what he wanted.
Right.
You know, so he kind of got me away from that and, you know, showed me, you know, what I should do.
So when you played with Leather Charm and you guys eventually formed that band, was it mostly original stuff?
It was. We had one original song, a song called Hit the Lights.
Mm.
And the other songs were all copies. And that whole band just kind of folded. And
did you play gigs at all?
We never played.
Okay.
We never got out of the garage with Leather Charm.
Mm-hmm.
But and then I said, and James said, you know, I want to just be a singer, you know, and I want to find a band, you know. He's living with me at this point, in our house, and he said, I just want to be a singer, you know. I want to find a band, you know. I'm like, okay. So I just kind of backed out and did my own thing, and they started auditioning people. And one day he brings over Lars, a guy that I had met before one time. I had met him at a Judas Priest concert. James brought him out of the crowd, and they had no shirts on, and they'd been up like sweating their asses off, and they stunk like crap. And I was like, oh, this is Lars. I'm like, oh, okay.
You just ran into Lars like at,
yeah,
the,
just like that.
The
yeah,
concert?
It's like, yeah, okay, Lars. Yeah, that's for James knew him apparently, but I didn't know him.
Right.
So he brought him over, and he said, well, he's a drummer. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So he brought over his drum set eventually, and so he started playing. I was like, I don't know about that. I don't think he's too good.
Because Lars basically just decided he wanted to form a band.
Yeah,
and just put together a drum kit.
It seemed to me that he had just spur of the moment decided to be a drummer.
Right.
But this kid, he was from Europe, and he knew all these bands. He hung out with all these bands in Europe and stuff. And he's like, Motorhead this and Diamond had this. So I'm like, wow, that's cool. But, you know, I don't think he's that good on drums, you know. So I just kind of backed out of it. And they tried out other bass players and guitar players and stuff to get this band going. And one time they got a call. We got a call at my house. And I answered the phone. And it was a guitar player. And he says, yeah, I got 4 Marshall stacks. I got 17 guitars. And I'm like, whoa, huh? Okay. I said, James or Lars, you guys take this call because this guy's head is not going to fit through the door. And that was Dave Mustaine. And Dave Mustaine.
Right off the bat.
Yeah.
Huh?
And Dave Mustaine came in and he plugged in and he was just warming up. And it was like, holy crap, this guy's good. This guy's really good. And they had another bass player there for about a week or two. And this guy couldn't keep up. And I was just sitting there with nothing to do, and they're playing Hit the Lights. And he said, Ron, show him how to play Hit the Lights. So I took his bass, and I'm like, so we played Hit the Lights, and they kind of, well, why don't you go home? Hey, will you be in the band to me? I said, okay, I guess I got nothing else to do. So.
Right.
But like I said, it was never really, I never really tried out to be in the band, and it was just something that, you know, I was there, and it was available, and it was never going to be a long-term thing until they found something somebody, you know,
that for, fit that vibe better.
Right, right. Well,
what did you think about the music? Because, I mean, even Hit the Lights, if you're talking about 1981 or 82, it's so fast. Like, now it's just, you know, everybody plays fast, so you just take it as it is. But at that time, nobody was playing music like that.
Right.
What did you guys, what did you think about that?
I thought it was, you know, I'd heard Motorhead and, you know, stuff like that. I thought it was, you know, about that speed and stuff, but the riffs were a lot more intricate. You know, there's a lot more changes and everything. And then Dave brought in Jump at the Fire, you know, and that brought a whole different vibe to the whole thing. And I thought, well, you know, this is kind of pretty good. But we only had two songs, and we wanted to start gigging and stuff, and we were practicing gigging, but so we started playing all these Diamond Head songs.
Was that Lars's idea?
Yeah. You know, we started playing, and Diamond Head to me was kind of a Led Zeppelin-ish, you know, kind of long songs that kind of went on and on and on. It was a Led Zeppelin. And then we played Blitzkrieg and Killing Time, and other, some other songs that, you know, we kind of dropped away. But, you know, we had enough, so with the, I mean, especially with the Diamond Head song being so long, we had enough for, material, for a show, you know.
What was the dynamic like in the band at that point in time when you guys were jamming?
It was pretty good, actually, at that point. It was you know, we were practicing every day, 3-4 hours a day, and... You know, everybody was getting good. I remember we would turn off our lights in the studio just so we could know what it would be like if the lights went out. We could still play when the lights went out, you know?
Just in case?
Yeah, just in case
there's a power outage.
Yeah, like the lights went out. Can we still play the songs? Yeah, and so we turned the lights out.
Was Dave the leader, Lars the leader, James the leader? Everybody just kind of throwing their own 2 cents in?
Well, it was... Dave and James kind of, you know, they work together pretty good, but Lars is the master of putting the riff together in the correct order, you know, and he belts out riffs with his voice, and hey, play this, you know, whatever, and somebody will copy it and they'll say, yeah, we'll take that and we'll put it here or we'll put it here. And so they had all these riff tapes of all these riffs, you know, this riff and that riff, and nothing ever, you know, if you put it together right, if you listen to it, it wouldn't make any sense. But if you go and pick and choose ones, you know, to put in certain songs, it all made sense. Yeah. But, and we actually took some of our old Leather Charm songs, took those apart, took some of the riffs, and made a song called No Remorse. And so No Remorse, if you listen to it, it's like, there was a song called Handsome Ransom that we had, the din and din 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 din. You know, that's Handsome. That's Handsome Ransom. And then we had a song called Let's Go Rock and Roll, and it went dun da da dun da dun da dun da da dun da da, and that was Let's Go Rock and Roll. So we kind of took other songs and took them apart,
pieced them together.
Yeah,
it's interesting because when I had Lars on this show and he was talking about how they've always written songs that way, even up to not Death Magnetic, Hardwired, and that Lars puts this and changed this. And it's interesting that you say that because that's exactly what Lars said. We've always done it this way, cut and paste and Frankenstein them together to see which songs work best in these different orders, you know. So tell us about when you guys are jamming and you got all this material. What's the first gig like? How was the first gig?
First gig was March 14th of 1982 at a little club called Radio City in Anaheim, California. And right now, it was in a little strip mall, and next door was a club called Woodstock. So we ended up playing Woodstock later, but Radio City was our first gig. And, you know, we go hit the lights, bum, ba, pa, and then Dave breaks 2 strings on his guitar, no other backup. So he's sitting there changing the strings, and we're just sitting there like, dun, 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 dun. What are we
going
to do?
Stop?
Yeah, we stop. It's like, what are we going to do now? We're just going to sit here, and then we're going to sit there and wait for him to tune it back up.
How many people were there?
Maybe about 40, 50, something like that. Yeah, but I mean, most of them were, you know, comps from us. You know, they're all our friends. Yeah.
How did you get that gig?
I think we just went over there with a demo, and they just put us in there in any slot. It was like probably a Monday night, you know, something like that. But yeah, that was it. Wasn't really good.
So when Dave fixed the strings, then you started over again.
Yeah, we started over again. We hit the lights, and we were playing "Sucking My Love" from Diamond Head. We were playing that at that point. You know, that was the first time that we ended up dropping because it, you know, we had too many songs. We started every time we'd get a new song, we'd drop a Diamond Head song, we get a new song, drop a Diamond Head song.
So, play mostly
but they kept what well, we kept Am I Evil for some reason. We kept on playing that. People wanted to hear that one.
So it's a long one too.
Yeah, we kept that one.
So then when you do the Radio City gig, and does it start becoming more frequent that you're doing shows, and is there starting to be a buzz about the band? Or
it started, we played that gig, and we were supposed to play the Woodstock on the 26th, which is a couple weeks later. And in the meantime, within those couple of weeks, we found out that Saxon was going to be playing at the Whiskey a Go-Go on their Denim and Leather tour. So we're like, man, we got to get on that. So we had cut a, not really, well, we put out a 4-track demo. I'm trying to think of what songs. I'm thinking it's Blitzkrieg, Killing Time, Hit the Lights, and Jump in the Fire.
Right? So this wasn't the famous No Life to Leather demo.
This is
the first
song demo, just to give to people to see, you know, how what people thought. So I said, you know what, I'm going to go down to the Whiskey. I'm going to try to get us on that bill. So about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm standing out there in Hollywood on the corner, you know, Vine and Sunset and Vine, and there's a Whiskey Go-Go, and I'm standing there with this cassette in my hand, and I'm looking up. What the hell am I going to do now? How am I going to get in here? Just at that point, I look up the hill, and here comes Tommy and Nikki from Motley Crue. And I had known them because I followed Motley Crue around. I mean, I went and saw their shows all the time, and they knew me. I took pictures at that time. I used to take pictures for Motley Crue. And I was standing there, and they come down the hill. First thing he asked me, he said, "Hey, Ron." I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "You got any toot?" I'm like, "Oh, no. Don't do that, man."
He's AKA like, cocaine, right?
Yeah. So I'm like, they said, "Well, what are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I'm trying to get my band in on to play that Saxon show." They said, "Yeah, we heard about that show, but we're too big now. We can't really play that show. But I'll get you in to talk to the girl up there, you know?" So took me in, went up there, gave her a demo tape. And she called me back a few days later and said, "Yeah, you guys are on with Saxon on the 27th. And the 26th, we were supposed to play at the Woodstock, but Saxon was playing the 26th and 27th. So we go down on the 26th, we go down to the Woodstock to play. We're like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And they wanted to put us on at like after midnight or something. Said, "Screw it, we're not playing. We're going back to Hollywood. We're going to go see Saxon." So we went back and saw Saxon. And then we played the next night. We played 2 shows with Saxon. So our second show was opening for Saxon.
At
the Whiskey, which was pretty
cool. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
How was that gig?
That was pretty awesome. Ozzy was there. Randy Rhoads had just been killed. And Ozzy was sitting in the back over there, kind of, you know. But he was sitting there, and the guys from Motley Crue showed up. I remember standing there between songs. I saw Nikki Sixx walk up the stairs. He's like, gives me like a high, you know, a
shaka,
sign.
Yeah, the Aloha sign.
Yeah. It's like, he was my hero. Nikki Sixx is watching me play. You know, I'm usually watching him play.
Right. What was the scene like back then? You mentioned Motley Crue. What other bands did you follow back then?
Oh, well, Rat was always playing. They played, you know, all over the place. Armored Saint was playing all the time.
Everyone talks to Armored Saint was like the band that everyone loved back at that point.
Yeah, everybody loved Armored Saint. Mm-hmm. I mean, their whole post, you know, apocalyptic, you know, road warrior kind of thing was cool, you know. And we got along with those guys really good, you know. And
the Sunset Strip was the place to be.
Oh, it was, yeah. But you see, I lived in the suburbs. So it was kind of a place you could go to, but you could leave and go back to your normal life. You didn't have to live there and be in it all the time. So, but Rat was always there. They'd call us up. Rat would call us up. Hey, you want to play with us? We ended up playing with Rat like 4 or 5 times.
Metallica and Rat.
Yeah, yeah. They would call us up. They'd say, hey, you want to open for us on blah, blah, blah. And we'd say, sure. And then we find out later that they thought that we sucked so bad that it made them sound so much better. So, you know, that's the way it was back
sure,
then.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, everybody, it was a glam, you know, thing. And then we get up there and we just look like the Ramones, you know, getting up there in jeans and T-shirts. And they're like, what the hell is this?
This is fit, yeah.
Yeah.
How about the name? What was it like when you guys were trying to think of a name?
I remember other names going around like Thunder and Red Vet. And
Red Vet?
Yeah, Red Vet. Like, you know, what? Red Vet?
Thunder is pretty awesome, too.
Yeah. But I don't know. Oh, yeah, that's how Lars stole that name from Ron Quintana from San Francisco. He was doing that fanzine, and he was trying to think of a name for the fanzine, and he told Lars, and he's like, no, Metallica, that he wanted to call the fanzine Metallica, and Lars is like, no, that's a bad name, call it Heavy Metal Mania. So Lars steals Metallica, and then,
but once again though, like, you know, Metallica is such a, you know, iconic name, but when you first heard it, it was kind of weird.
Yeah,
you know, were you thinking like, what the hell is a Metallica?
Yeah, I know. I had one of the original Metallica shirts, and I was in I was at the Troubadour bar or something, and David Lee Roth sits next to me, and he's like, what's up, man? You know, now David Lee Roth, but he sees my shirt, he says, Metallica. He's like, what is that, man? I'm like, it's our band. He's like, wow, cool, man. So I was like, yeah, David Lee Roth knows who Metallica is now.
He liked it too. He gave us the thumbs up. Yeah.
Yeah.
So as the band continues, how many shows are you doing at this point in time? Is it still very sporadic, or did you ever put together a tour?
It was pretty much every week or every other week. We were getting, you know, we were playing Orange County clubs, the LA clubs and stuff. And then later in the fall, we got invited to play shows in San Francisco, and that's where things kind of got crazy.
You know, in what way?
Because we, you know, we were used to getting off stage and or having ending a song, and you can hear the ice in people's drinks. Yeah. You know, it's like crickets and frogs, you know, down in LA. But we go to San Francisco, and there's people that actually know who we are. You know, this was after we had released No Life to Leather, and people are standing around the corner, you know, waiting to see us. I'm like, I'm driving my dad's 1969 Ford Ranger pickup truck with a camper shell, and these guys are in the back hauling a, you know, trailer full of equipment, and just not used to this at all. You know, we're just used to being shunned.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you've got people actually wanting to come see you, which was strange.
Huge, yeah.
Yeah, that was strange.
What was it like, I mean, as far as like the party scene? You guys go and drink after every show, or?
Well, we drank during the show.
During the show?
Yeah, it was, you know, liquid courage pretty much. You know, we had to. I remember drinking we drank peppermint schnapps. I'll tell you why we drank peppermint schnapps, because when I was about 16, I was looking around in my father's garage, and I found this open bottle of peppermint schnapps. I'm like, what's this? So I tried it. I'm like, heck yeah. So all of us started drinking that stuff, but we get the half pints, and we put them in our back pockets, and we just down one. And I remember being, hey, I had to go down these stairs to get on stage at the Whiskey, and it was pitch black, and I'm like, I fell, and I thought, oh my god, I'm gonna break this bass in half. Yeah. I thought I was.
Yeah, to get on the stage, you gotta walk down the stairs.
Walk these little stairs, and it was pitch black, and I'm carrying this bass. It's like Spinal Tap, you know, hello Cleveland kind of thing. And you go down there, and I trip, and I'm like, oh crap, bam, you know. But, we did that a lot. We had beer on stage, we had pitchers of someone, obviously we weren't old enough to drink, but people would buy us beer, you know. And
was everybody still cool at that point in time within the band, or they got a little bit loaded? Everybody treat each other nice?
Yeah, everybody was okay, but you know, Well, Lars and James, you know, we all kind of, you know, we all got along and we drank, but we didn't get completely ripped out of our mind. But, you know, Dave, he would sometimes get just so loaded that he was out of control, and it wasn't good whenever he got like that. It wasn't.
Do you like, is there a story he poured beer in your base once or something like that?
Yeah. He decided he didn't like me. So I wasn't there. My friend let him into the house, and he just took a beer and just poured it right down into my base. And
why did he decide he didn't like you?
I don't know, because I guess, you know, those guys kind of looked up to him. But I'd tell him, hey, man, you're acting like an asshole.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, I would tell him, look, you know, you're acting like an asshole. Don't come over to my house. Don't destroy my stuff. You know, I would tell him. But those guys, they wouldn't say anything to him. So he didn't like...
Because he was such a good player.
Yeah. He didn't like that I, you know, I told him what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so he decided he didn't like me. And, you know, there was a time when he was... Well, he's already said this in interviews anyway, that he was dealing weed.
Mm-hmm.
And
writes about it in his book.
He actually brought it over to my house. He brought it because he was afraid to leave it at his house because somebody might steal it from him. So he'd bring it to my house. I'm like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But so he got these pit bulls, and he lived in an apartment. I don't know what he's going to do with pit bulls in an apartment, but he brought them over to my house, and I was in the shower, and James came to the door, and he had these pit bulls, and James said, you can't have those dogs here. They started jumping on, scratching my car, and he said, hey, you're scratching Ron's car. And Dave, apparently he'd been drinking or something all day, but he got pissed, and I heard a commotion. I jumped out of the shower, I'm in a towel, and they were nose to nose, and then all of a sudden Dave punches James right in the face, and I was like, what the hell? And I jumped on Dave, his back, and he threw me over into a coffee table.
Wow.
And then we said, you're out of the band. We kicked him out of the band right there. So he loaded up all his stuff and took off. Next day he came back, can I be back in the band? Okay, well, I guess we don't have another guitar player, so yeah, you're back in the band. So.
Did you play on the Metal Massacre on Hit the Lights?
On the very first Metal Massacre, the very first pressing with Lloyd Grant and stuff, James played bass on that because I wasn't there for some reason. But on the second pressing is basically the one from No Life to Leather. It's the same one from No Life to Leather.
So No Life to Leather had Hit the Lights, No Remorse. What else was on it?
I'm not sure
it was on it. Yeah.
It had Hit the Lights, Jump in the Fire, and Motor Breath, Mechanics, Dave's song,
which later became Four Horsemen.
Right. Metal Militia.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my gosh, I know there's seven songs on there.
Oh, because there's quite a few of the songs that ended up on Kill 'Em All.
Yeah, the only songs that's not on there that's on Kill 'Em All is Whiplash and No Remorse.
So Phantom Lord is on it.
Phantom Lord's on it. Yeah.
Mechanics, right. Seek and Destroy.
Yeah. Mm. They're all on there.
So what are you thinking of these songs as you guys are creating? Like, is Lars and James writing them and then saying, okay, here's how it goes?
Right. Yeah. See, I was the only one that had a full time job.
Where were you working?
So I was. My parents had a truck repair company, and as a matter of fact, James's father had a trucking company across the street.
Wow!
So they knew each other from business, and so I was the only one with a full time job, and they would sit there all day and create music, and then I'd get home from work, and they'd say, "Here, you know, here's how it goes. You know, play this and." I'd play the song, and then we'd practice for a few hours, and the next couple of days they'd add another song, and you know, that's the way it kind of worked, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you went up to San Francisco, were you hanging out with the bands up there?
Not really. We didn't really know anybody up there. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't know any of the bands.
I guess the Exodus and those type of bands didn't come till later.
Yeah. Well, Exodus, they showed up They got on the bill with us. They opened up for us, as a matter of fact, when I was in the band. And I remember Kirk Hammett, he was in Exodus, and he came up to me and he said, "Man, I love Metallica. You know, you guys are awesome." Mm-hmm. I said, "Man, I watched your band. You guys are awesome too." You know, little did I know, you know.
Right.
Yeah. But
it's interesting that, there was a band like Exodus playing that type of heavy music, mm-hmm. the same way that Metallica was. It was kind of the scene was spreading at that point in time. Right. Yeah.
Right.
So when did you start? I guess, when did you hear about Cliff Burton, and when did that start going on? I mean, were you Metallica for a lot longer? Was there more stuff that happened, or?
That happened in, I want to say in the fall, sometime in 1982. His band Trauma came to play at the Troubadour, and Brian Slagle from Metal Blade had invited us to go watch them. So we were all sitting there watching them, and I'm like, well, you know, kind of music's not my kind of thing. Yes. Yeah, not my kind of thing. But all of a sudden, you know, it was me and James and Lars, and all of a sudden Cliff starts going into this solo, and there's like looking at him with their eyes are wide open, and I'm looking at them, and they're looking at him, and I'm like, yep, this is the guy. This is it. This is it. I mean, so I kind of knew. Right at that point, I'm like, yep, this is the guy they're going to go after. I could tell.
Yeah.
I mean, he was just a thrashing, you know, head banging, crazy, awesome bass player.
What did you think of him?
I thought he was awesome, too. He's doing stuff that I can never do, you know.
Right.
So as soon as I saw their reaction, you know, I kind of knew.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of knew. And, you know, I played several gigs after that with them. And they never actually told me, hey, you know, we're going to get, you know, we want to get this guy, you know. I kind of heard through the grapevine, but I already knew who it was going to be. Mm. And I remember one time playing in San Francisco, and Cliff was there watching us, and he was standing there out in the rain, and I asked him, hey man, do you want to ride? Because he was standing there, he was soaking wet. He's like, nah, I'm cool, you know, but, you know, I was going to give him a ride back to wherever he wanted to go, but... You know, I knew he was going to be the guy. Mm-hmm. So, but that was never my role.
That's what you were saying.
Yeah, it was never my role to be the long-term bass player.
Did you know that at the time?
I knew that, but, you know, you kind of put it in the back of your mind because you keep playing shows and you're learning new songs and you're playing and, you know, you're playing all these gigs, you're going to San Francisco, and then, you know, you see him play and I'm like, well, oh yeah, I'm not going to be... Yeah, that wasn't what I was going to do, you know.
And you say that because your skill level wasn't at the same as theirs, or your desire or passion, or...
Yeah, I guess, well, kind of both, I guess, because I wanted to be a motorcycle mechanic. I wanted to ride dirt bikes in the desert all the time. That's what I wanted to do. You know, I mean, I remember going, I'd be out at Glamis, out in the sand dunes, and I'd be riding. I'm like, man, it's so good to get away from those guys. You know, this is what I want to do. I want to be out on the road, you know, I want to be away from that. I want to, I don't want the fighting. I don't want the arguing. I don't want the bickering. You know, it's just like a relationship, you know, I mean, it could be male, female. It's the same kind of thing. It's like, I don't need this. I don't want to be in that. But, you know, I didn't ever, my whole thing was never to be a rock star. I was never my intention. I was just helping James out. All I wanted to do really was get in Leather Charm, play some backyard parties, drink some kegs, you know,
pick up some chicks.
Yeah, that's it. That was all I wanted to do. But then when we got to play Hollywood clubs, I'm like, wow, I get to play, you know, places I've seen other bands, you know. I see Motley Crue up there, and I'm on the same stage, you know, as The Doors played, or you know, and stuff
famous
like that.
Place, yeah.
Yeah, I thought looked at more of a historical kind of
which
a
still
thing.
Goes to this day. The first time we played the Whiskey was the same thing, and we've been fortunate to play 3 or 4 times since, but it's like, it's the freaking Whiskey, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those places.
I know. You know. Yeah.
Did you mostly just tour then California? Did you guys ever do any road trips outside of California?
No, we just did San Francisco, LA, Orange County.
But when you went to San Francisco, you was in your dad's
In the 69 Ford pickup.
Did you ever have any adventures on the road?
I remember driving up there, and that old pickup truck had two fuel tanks, And it's not like nowadays where you just push a button to switch a fuel tank. It was back then, it was an actual manual valve. So I reached down to switch it to the second tank, and it broke off in my hand. And we had half a tank. I'm like, oh my God, we're in the middle of nowhere. I hope we can find somewhere. Finally, we found a gas station, hung out until it opened up in the morning. But we made it to San Francisco. But I remember coming back one time, and somehow they got a hold of because it was me and my other friend, Dave, and he was our drum roadie, and we were in the front, and James, Lars, and Dave were in the back, and somehow they got a gallon of vodka from somewhere. And we're going down Interstate 5, and they'd be bashing on the window, I gotta pee, pull over, and then they do all kinds of weird crap on the side of the road. Lars went out and laid out on the middle of the road and on the Interstate 5. I was like, oh my God, and I had a lot of responsibility. I mean, I was borrowing my parents' car. Right. I rented a trailer. I told the guy I'd rent the trailer from, I said, I'm only going to haul some furniture within like 20 miles. I didn't tell him I was taking it all the way to San Francisco, So I had a lot of responsibility, and that they didn't have to feel, So I'm like, it's kind of like
you're almost a designated driver.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. It's kind of like in Animal House with Flounder, and he's like trying to save all this. They're trying to break all that stuff. And he's like, no, don't break all this. It's like that. They would take pool balls. I had this big Eddie from Iron Maiden, a big cutout I got from a record store, and it was up on the wall.
Like a poster?
Yeah. Well, it was a cardboard cutout.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and we had a pool table, and they take the pool balls and throw it and just crash the pool balls into the walls, when they got drunk and stuff. I'm like, no, don't do that. This is my house. You can't do that kind of stuff,
So, yeah, because you always hear the legendary alcoholica and just the lunacy, drinking and all that sort of stuff.
But I think it got worse after I left, mm-hmm. Whenever they went up there.
Right. So when did you finally finally tell you that Cliff was in and that you were not in anymore?
Actually, that never really happened. After the whole bass thing. Actually,
which
one of
thing?
the bass on oh, the beer and the bass.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of the last straw. Mm. But before that, we played a show in Long Beach, and I had just gotten that Washburn bass, and I had a Ibanez Roadster bass as my old one as a backup, and that bass disappeared. It disappeared from the show. And find out later that, somebody might have had it stolen for money. So that was a big deal. Things were disappearing from my house. And then that whole beer thing on my base, I was like, you guys just need to get out. I'm done with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this didn't have to go down like this.
Right. You think they were trying to push you out or something?
Yeah, it didn't have to go down like this. All you had to do was say, hey, we found a guy,
Yeah.
And I would have been, awesome, great, good luck to you. But it didn't go down that way, and I'm sorry it didn't, but...
Did you ever talk to James about it and say, what's up, dude?
Not until they came around back after Dave got booted and Kirk was in the band. They came around in 83, and I found out their phone number in San Francisco, and I called them and I said, you guys are playing the country club out here in LA. You guys want to stay at my house? And at that point, I only had like a couple months before they were going to tear the house down.
All right.
I said, I don't care what you do to it. So they all showed up. So they showed up and stayed at my house and, kind of trashed the place, and I didn't really care. We talked about that. Everybody was there. Cliff was there, the whole band. Even Dave Mustaine showed up, and I wish I would have got a picture with all of us together, mm-hmm. but I could never get Dave and Kirk in the same room.
Wow, yeah, I see.
At that point. So
Dave even showed up?
Dave showed up at that party, I had a party kind of like when they were, just as they got there before they played the country club, and Dave showed up, and I was like, man, this would be a great picture, the band, and then me, and then Dave, and, well, I never could get them two to take a picture together. So
have you ever, I mean, I'm sure you've spoken to Mustaine since then. Or
I've talked to him, and you know, Megadeth plays like Charlotte or something, you know, he'll call me up, yeah, why don't you come down and watch this, you know, so mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's kind of made peace with them after.
Yeah.
It's amazing when you're young, the stupid shit that you do, right?
Yeah, you know, when you're young, you know, everything is such a big deal. But when you look back at it, you know, 35 years later, it's like, man, that was nothing compared to what's coming up, you know?
How did you feel, though, when I mean, you're basically out of the band? Like, you mentioned that you wish it would have gone down differently, but did you miss playing bass? Did you continue playing bass?
I sold almost all my stuff at that point, and I didn't get back into playing until my friend Caton DePanna from Hyrax. Mm-hmm. He was a friend of ours, and he asked me, he said, man, you want to, he said, I'm kind of at a hiatus with those guys. You want to get a band together? So I said, yeah, man, you know, we'll play some AC/DC covers or something like that. But then it, you know, it was a band called Phantasm, and we started.
Phantasm.
Yeah. And we started playing shows and stuff with originals, and it was like, oh my god, here we go again. this is the same thing. I can see it coming. And him being the lead singer, he didn't like that people would come to talk to me about Metallica. You know, he didn't really dig that. So that whole band kind of went away, which, I mean, it was pretty good. I mean, we're like in the kind of skate thrash metal, more thrash metal band, you know. I had a lot more fun with that band because I was writing songs and, you know, the other in Metallica, it was James and Lars and Dave. I just played what they wanted. But in Phantasm, you know, I was writing riffs, I was writing songs, I kind of like that. But, you know, just kind of egos and things kind of, you know.
Did you ever try and write any songs for Metallica?
I did some arranging that, you know, they'd never admit to as far as riffs and stuff, how are you going to tell James Hetfield? Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
same thing happened to Newstead when he joined, you know, Trujillo now. It's like there's not a lot of riffs being thrown around that aren't James's, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, but James is like a riff machine. Yeah. You know, that's what he is. That's what
he
does.
Right, right. Yeah. What songs did you help arrange?
I remember some of the solos in... oh man.
That's Phantom Lord.
Yeah, Phantom Lord. Yeah. Some of the Phantom, Dave would come out of it, and it kind of, when he would come out of it and it didn't sound right, and then I'd say, well, James, why don't you take and do the next part, you know, so it kind of flows together. So it, you know, I was doing some of that stuff, but as far as the riffs and stuff, you know, it was their band, you know, I knew that, but, you know, when we started making Metallica t-shirts and stuff, it's like, wow, you know, it's like, hey, I'm in this band. How cool is that?
How was it for you? Like, or what did you think of their rise? Did you see it coming? Did you expect it?
No, I remember being at the Palladium. They played the Palladium and they opened for Armored Saint. It was like 1984. I walk in the Palladium. I'm looking at it like, man, this place is huge. I'm like, this is as big as they're going to get. This is it right here. They're opening for Armored Saint. This is as big as Metallica's going to ever get. Well, obviously, you know, I was obviously wrong, but I do remember. And then they had come before they came out with Ride the Lightning. Lars called me up. He said, he said, I'm in L.A. and want you to hear a song. Okay. So he brings over this test pressing, and he puts on Fade to Black. But at first he said, oh, we're going to do a ballad. I'm like, a ballad? Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
So he puts on that slow, you know, part of it, and I was like, are you kidding me? There's no way this is going to go over, you know, there's no way. But I didn't know it would become so iconic, you know. I never thought that would ever go over. I mean, all the other songs, you know, were all heavy, you know, you know, Creeping Death and all that was, you know, that was awesome. But when he put on Fade to Black, I was like,
it was such a departure.
Yeah, what
at the
are
time.
You guys doing? You know,
when you were out of the band, did you have a good fan base of Metallica fans that were wondering what happened to you? Or
this is way before internet and then stuff like that. You know,
when you're there next day, you're gone.
Yeah, it's like nobody even really knew. But I mean, people finally figured out. After the internet hit, people started researching the band and like, who's this guy Ron McGovney? You know, who is this? And all of a sudden they start finding me, you know, and, you know, asking me for interviews. And I'm like, how do you know who I am? Oh, found you on the internet. Oh, okay. Maybe I'll check that out.
Right. Yeah. When would you still hang out with them when they would come through town throughout the 80s? And
oh yeah, in the 80s they would call me up and say, "Hey, we're playing a secret show with the Troubadour." You know, it was before when Jason just joined.
Mm-hmm.
And they were playing. I remember I drove down. I had a Ford Ranger, 86 Ford Ranger, with just a single cab, and we picked up James and Jason. And my friend Rich was riding with me, and I didn't have anywhere for those guys to ride, so me and James rode in the front, and we put those two in the back. And we were riding around Hollywood with those guys in the open back of my pickup truck, you know? Yeah. It's like, huh.
Yeah, that's okay. What we used to do it. You can't do that nowadays.
No,
all the time.
No, but I mean, I kind of felt bad. You know, I put in the bass player from Metallica in the back of my truck while we're driving in the front listening to the music, and they're probably freezing their ass off in the back.
What did you think when you found out that Cliff had passed away?
I think I heard it on KNAC, the rock station back
the
then.
Time, yeah.
Somebody had said that somebody in Metallica had been killed, but they didn't say who.
Mm.
And they left it for hours like that. It was like, oh my God, who is it? You know. And then when they said Cliff, and I heard the details, you know, I couldn't believe that because, on their 86 tour, they played at Long Beach Arena. And I had been back there, backstage. And the other guys weren't there, but just Cliff. And Cliff and I were sitting there talking, and we were eating Chinese food together. You know, and I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool, you know. And, you know, we're just talking, me and Cliff. And I said, well, I'm going to go, you know, I'll go watch you guys. I'll see you guys after. And then I remember after the show, I went back and I didn't ever see Cliff again, and I never knowing that, you know, that would be the last time I ever saw him, you know.
Was he a pretty cool guy?
He was down to earth. I mean, he came over to my house down in L.A. and stuff, and, you know, he was just really awesome guy. He was really respectful of me for my tenure in the band.
That's cool.
Which was really nice. I remember at that Palladium show in 84, I guess it was, whenever the Ride of Lightning, I had a pass, but it was just like a sticker pass, and I wanted to go back in the back and talk to him, but they wouldn't let me in. Cliff saw me, and he gave me his laminate, and I walked back there, and they're tour manager tore him up. He said, why'd you give him the lemon? He said, he was the first base for Metallica. Yeah, okay.
You know? That's cool. Yeah. Did you ever, when you ever talked to me, ever bitch like, that feels driving me crazy or anything
no,
like that?
No, he never did. No. No, I heard some from Jason, but nothing.
Oh, did
really.
You? Well, then, then Jason comes in. It's like the third ex-wife sort of thing, right?
Yeah, I never heard anything from Cliff, but
would Jason tell you?
Jason, I mean, he would tell me that James is pissed at me. I'm like, well, fucking pissed at me. I don't even see the guy, you know?
Mm.
But he'd kind of tell me what's going on with the band and stuff, you know, and, you know, not too cool the way he was being treated at that point, but you know, I guess I don't know if he really knew that he was kind of in that same position that I was in, but I mean, I knew that going in. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he knew that going in
as far as
his role. Mm-hmm. In the band is, you know, you know you're just playing bass,
right?
That's what you're doing. We're writing the music and you're playing.
Which has got to be hard for him too, because he was like the major songwriter in Flotsam and Jetsam.
Right.
But like you said, you could kind of sit back and say like, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So what did you do after that then? Did you end up becoming a motorcycle mechanic?
No, we closed our business in 1992, and I went to work for the city of Long Beach. So I worked there for about 6 years. And then on the side, I did some repos. I repoed cars, had a tow truck, repoed some cars in some bad neighborhoods and with people pulling guns and things.
And that's pretty scary.
Yeah. And then moved out to
so
North.
Repoing is like you got to go take their cars away with
you? Yeah.
What would people do if they saw you?
Yeah, we had a, Yeah, we had, it was in the middle of the night in Watts or Compton, one of those neighborhoods. And, you know, I really don't fit in that kind of a neighborhood. You know, you kind of pick me out. But, yeah, this woman pulled a gun, and I ran down to the phone booth at that time when they had phone booths and called the cops, and they came and, you know, took care of it. But, yeah, I just didn't want that to happen anymore, so I got out of that business. Mm-hmm. And so then I moved out here into North Carolina in 1999. My son Justin and his brother and sister, they moved out a year before me. Mm-hmm. And I stayed to work a little bit so I can gain some extra money and stuff. And I moved out here permanently in 99.
What do you do out here now?
I work in a factory. Well, I don't really want to say where, but...
I gotcha, yeah.
But, yeah, I've been working at this factory for 18 years. Mm. And I'm kind of looking... I can see the end at retirement, you know, you know, in my eyes. You know, I'm thinking something that I like to do, you know, whenever I retire. But, no, yeah. I mean, throughout the years, it's been pretty cool that, Metallica has, you know, included me in things like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
So tell us about that. So what did they do? Because obviously you didn't get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But
right. Right. But they called, they said, look, we're being inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We want you to be part of it. You know, we want you to be there. So I said, heck yeah. So they flew me out to Cleveland. They had a party the night before at the House of Blues, I think it was. And Jimmy Page was there. Joe Perry was there. I was like, I took James aside. I said, dude, you gotta understand, these are guys that we had up on our walls and they're standing right here. He's like, isn't it crazy? You know, yeah. It's wild.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, I had this huge Jimmy Page poster in my room when I was, you know, 16. And and there he is standing right there between James and Joe Perry. And I took this picture. James is standing in the middle and Jimmy Page is on one side, Joe Perry's on the other side.
That's cool.
How awesome is this?
And they're all at the same level at this point.
Yeah. And it's like, you would have never thought, ever, you know.
Did they say anything to you at all? Like, you know, like, did you talk to them?
Yeah.
Or is it more just like, hey, Ron, or is it like, you know?
Well, I mean, no, they'll come up to me and, well, James will tell me, look, you know, I know, you know, the things didn't go well, you know, in the band or it, and stuff, but you were a big part of our success. And I want you to be there, you know. And James, to this day, he keeps this picture that we went to Magic Mountain in when we were in high school in 1980. And we were at Magic Mountain and we went to this photo booth. And you could pick a cover of a magazine you wanted, like Sports Illustrated or whatever, and there was a Hit Parader. I said, well, put us on Hit Parader. So there's this picture, you can find it on the internet, of me and James with this Hit Parader background when we were in high school. And he keeps that, and he has it right at the Metallica at their headquarters in San Francisco. And you can see they have a couch in front of it. And they'll do interviews, and you can see that picture right there in the background. I was like, "Well,
that's kind of a
thumbs up to the old days, you know."
It's cool that he says that sort of stuff to keep you involved.
Yeah, and you know, when I saw him in Atlanta when you were there, and he said, you know, he's talking about, you know, 40th anniversary. I'm like, yeah. I said, there's no way I would ever want to get on stage with you guys again. There's no way. I'm never doing that again. Because I did that at that 30th. He said, whatever you want, man. Just let me know whatever you want. You know, and he gave
James
me a hug.
That to you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said, whatever you want.
No. Why would you never go on stage?
No, that's just not my thing. I'm just, I've given that, I put that all behind me. I will absolutely be there to, you know, to raise my fist and be out there with the fans. Just like when we were in the pit. In the snake pit.
That's right.
We're in the snake pit.
In Atlanta, that's right.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, hell yeah.
I had that pillowcase, as a matter of fact, with me because I had just done a podcast with the Avenged guys earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, that's where I want to be. That's where I want to be, seeing my friends up there on stage where they belong. That's not where I belong. But, you know, it is cool being... having a plaque with my name on it in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Actually, there's a plaque in there talking about Hit the Lights and stuff, and it has mine and Dave's name on it.
That's and, cool to say that you guys played on it.
And it's talking about No Life to Leather or whatever. And I was like, well, you know, that's enough for me. I don't need any more than that.
What did you think about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Do you think you should have been in there?
No, neither Dave or me should have been in. I mean, Dave should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but, you know, with Megadeth, you know, as far as Metallica, not really, because, you know, he didn't really play on any official, you know, albums and stuff. But Dave absolutely deserves to be in there.
So tell me about the 30th anniversary, because I was there. I saw you play.
I had no idea that you were there.
Yeah, I was there. I went to two of the nights, and you were one of them.
I didn't see. I saw Randy Johnson, the Big Unit.
Oh, yeah.
I saw him. I was like, wow, how cool is this?
Well, and it was the coolest thing of all time, the greatest kind of anniversary party, where Metallica, and I counted, they played 20 songs a night, four nights, and they were all different except for Seek and Destroy. So they played 76 songs in four nights, and some that they had never played live before. Yeah. So how was that for you? What did they say to get you to do it, and what was the process like?
It was kind of a mix up. James emailed me, and he told me what songs he wanted me to play on, and I'm thinking it was Metal Militia and what other song, some other song, and then Metal Militia, Jump in the Fire, Seek and Destroy, and some other song. But anyway,
it's gonna be Phantom Lord or Motor Breath or Four Horsemen or whatever it was.
Yeah. But anyway, he told me, I said, well, I guess I gotta buy Kill 'Em All so I can relearn the songs. He's like, no, just think of No Life to Leather. So I'm like, okay. So I'm thinking No Life to Leather.
Which is the way you played it.
Right, the way I played it. And the songs have been changed. The songs have added parts.
Oh.
There have been songs that... But I don't think he even remembers that the songs have been changed.
Sure.
And then we get up there on a practice, to practice. And I was like...
Was it like the day of the show?
It was the day of the show. And I'm like, wait a minute. You're doing the Kill 'Em All. He's like... I said, you guys changed the songs. He's like, no, we didn't. I said, yes, you did. You told me No Life to Leather. So anyway, I only ended up playing on two of the songs, which were kind of the same. Even Seek and Destroy is different. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, crap.
And what was the other one? Was it Metal Militia you played on?
Yeah. Okay. No, Seek and Destroy and Hit the Lights.
Okay, gotcha. Now,
Hit the Lights is basically the same.
Yeah.
Seek and Destroy had a whole different ending part that we never used. And I was like, oh, shit. You know, this is going to suck.
Had you played at all?
No, I hadn't played in like 25 years. And then I'm practicing from the tape that I had. And then they just go with what they'd play all the time.
Yeah, I'm like,
oh, God.
How much warning did you have?
Like a couple
weeks before, a month before?
Oh, you mean to play the song?
Like, when did they tell you, okay, we're going to be doing this, it's 3 months from now, or it's...
Oh, it was in December.
Okay.
He probably told me in October.
Gotcha.
Something like that. So I was like, yeah, I'm ready. Yeah, and then all of a sudden I find out, oh, crap, this is the wrong version of the song. So anyway, I was like, just keep me on the last two, forget it.
Yeah. Did you make it through okay, though?
I was, you know, Big Mick, you know, that works for him. He's like, calm down, dude. It's okay. You know, I'm like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. I'm like freaking Forrest Gump standing up here. I mean, I'm standing here with this giant band. The last time I played with them was in San Francisco, you know, 30 years ago. And, you know, at a club down the street. Now they're like the biggest metal band in the world. And I'm up here on stage with them. And I mean, this...
It's like that dream that you have when you're on stage, you don't know the song.
Yeah.
You're just like,
I was like, crap. You know?
Have you ever got a chance to meet Robert?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I met him first time at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Does he treat you with respect
as well?
He was
very nice. Very nice, yeah. And I saw him in Atlanta again. And, you know, every time I've seen them with Rob, he's very, very cordial, very nice. And, you know.
Respectful of the entire lineage.
Very respectful.
Yeah.
You know, He calls me Metallica Mark One. You know, so I guess there is a Mark One. You know, if he's in Mark whatever they're at, four, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Do you actually be Mark Five, because there was Cliff and Dave in one version too. When just a couple more questions. When you go to Atlanta, and did you see Lars there?
Yeah, because
I was like, we went to that area where we met, kind of the VIP,
right?
And then you get summoned,
right,
to go see Lars. So did you get your summoning as well?
Yeah, they all came through.
Yeah, all of them.
I got to see all of them first. First James, and then Lars, and then Kirk, and then Robert, I think. But yeah, they all come through. But you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was kind of a lot more cool, because you know, everybody was there all together, and at that show, you know, I had a few beers anyway, so I was like, and I saw Robert standing there, and I saw Jason standing there. I'm like, how about let's get all three of us together?
That's cool.
So there's a picture. There's a picture of all three of us.
Yes.
And so I'm like, yeah, all the, you know, the surviving bass players.
I think I've seen that. That's cool.
Yeah.
I think I've actually saw it once where somebody photoshopped a picture of Cliff in the same size.
Yeah, over
you guys.
Over us. Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that was my idea. I said, I grabbed that girl who she was working for Metallica. I said, can we do this picture? And I got those guys, and you know, we did that one. I thought it was pretty cool.
There's a great picture of Phil Rudd, Simon Wright, and Chris Slade, the three drummers of AC/DC together. That's what it reminded me of.
Okay.
So what, how did when it's all said and done, how does it feel for you to know that you played a part in the beginning of what could possibly be the biggest band in the world, and by far the biggest heavy metal band in history?
Well, like I said this a little while ago, but some people have asked Dave Mustaine. I saw somebody ask him, do you think you're the godfather of thrash, you know? And he finally says, yeah, I guess I am, you know, kind of thing. Like I said, I'm the Forrest Gump of Metallica, because I was kind of there in history, but I didn't really know it. You know, you're playing on stage with all these, you know, icons and things, and you're just like, I mean, back then, obviously, you don't know, but, you know, you look at it now, it's like, you know, that's pretty awesome.
It's very awesome. Does this almost seem like another life?
Yeah, it is a whole different life. Yeah, it's like you have one previous life, and then, you know, your other life. Yeah.
Do you still, like, have connections with fans? Do you talk to fans at all, or you just kind of it is what it is?
When I had Facebook for a long time, and, you know, it just got to be too tedious and time consuming of people asking me for interviews and, you know, things like that, and so I finally just dropped it. And you know, there's only so much I can say, you know, back in the 80s, after that, people wanted to get in band, me to be in their band, just because of my connection with Metallica, and you know, that's not what I wanted to do. You know, that wasn't ever my original role. So,
have you ever thought about doing any of the conventions or anything like that? Like, were you signed for fans?
I've been invited to a couple of them. The horror conventions. So I've done one in Charlotte, and then I did one in, where the heck was the other one? Somewhere in the Midwest.
A lot of people that would want to come meet you, I think.
Make some good cash on that. Yeah, there's a lot of people, and I had some old flyers that I make copies of. And,
that's cool.
And people,
old band, you know, picture, yeah.
Band pictures. Yeah. You know, people love that stuff. So, yeah. But
you're part of history, dude. You're part of rock and roll history, you know?
I guess, but, you know, I just really don't feel like it, you know? I can look at it, you know, as a very good thing, because all the bad is all gone, you know, all that's gone. And, you know, my relationship with the guys in Metallica and even Dave is very good, you know, and
that's the most important thing, right?
Yeah. You know, and as we all get older, you know, we all mature. So, you know, you kind of let all that go. And
as far as the bitterness, exited out of the band,
right? You know, the bitterness and everything, and you know, I never had that feeling. Some people come up to me and say, well, how was it being, you know, you work in a factory and you used to be Metallica, that must suck. I'm like, but I've always had a job. I mean, that's what I did. I mean, I've always been a working man. That's what I've done. That's
And the Metallica you were in was basically a bar band,
garage
band, the garage band that made it to the next level. But it's not like it's I can see that affecting Mustaine more because he was actually kicked out
right
at the peak of like, and you know, writing songs and being. But for you, like you said, that was never, even you knew it was never the role for you to do that.
Exactly.
So I can see people, because people are people and want to, you know, talk that way. But for you, it's like, it's not like you had the world by the hand and blew it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like you were a part of this at a certain point in time and look at it as a very cool thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how many people that are my, I mean, I'll be 54 here in a couple few weeks. How many people my age were in a garage band when they were a teenager? Lots of them, but how many were in Metallica? None, you know. Yeah. But
so I must hate the fact that you have all your hair too.
Yeah, well,
he hates that.
I told Lars in Atlanta, you know, I said, I was talking to this guy, I said, what were you doing when you're 18? The guy said, well, I was a lifeguard. The other guy said, yeah, I hung out at the beach. I said, well, I was a bass player for Metallica. Cha-ching. Who wins that?
Yeah. It's a pretty good summer job.
Yeah.
Last question for you. What was your favorite songs to play live with Metallica?
Oh, that would be Whiplash, because that was the last song that was written when I was in the band.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came up with that song, it was just, that was awesome. You know, and then we played that in San Francisco and the people were just going nuts. Mm-hmm. You know, that was just...
Were you a pick player or finger player?
I was a pick player, because like I said, I was a guitar player, so I played it the way that James wanted me to play, and James always played with a pick, so he showed me how to play with a pick. He played with a pick, I played with a pick. So, you know, when I saw Jason play, I was like, you know, he's a lot like, you know, I was, but a lot more technical, but, you know, basically, because Cliff was in a different... Yeah.
And Rob's that vibe too.
And Rob too.
Two pick players, two finger players.
Yeah, and you know, Rob is an awesome, you know, I mean, Infectious Grooves.
Sure,
you know, it's
of
just
course.
Crazy stuff. You
yeah,
know?
And the fact that he plays Anesthesia like to the T.
Right.
I'm not sure if Jason ever did that. You know, so that's something that only a few people in the world can
and
do.
When we were in Atlanta and they had up on the screen, they had those pictures of Day on the Green with Cliff up there playing. And I was thinking, I was at Day on the Green.
Wow.
I was there. I drove up there and stayed. Actually, I stayed in my truck out in front of their house. Mm-hmm. I drove up there and they were practicing. And they were practicing in a garage, just like we were practicing. Yeah. You could hear them playing all, For Whom the Bell Tolls, all that stuff. It's like, how cool is this? But next day we went to, you know, saw him at Day on the Green. And I saw Cliff up there. And I'm like, wow, this is about where I was standing. I was not too far away. Right where he
in Atlanta and at that
and at that same show in 1985, and I was standing pretty much in the same spot. It was kind of weird looking at him that huge up there playing, just like I'm watching him. You know,
do you listen to? Are you still a Metallica fan?
Yeah. I like their new album's really good.
I agree.
I really like it.
Yeah. What's your favorite like Metallica a song? Like, what's your favorite as a bass player? At least knowing kind of the vibe, do you have a favorite Cliff song for bass? Or a Jason song or a Robert song, or you just listen to them as a band?
I like a lot of Jason stuff that's on the 598 EP, you know, the copy stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, Crash Course and all that stuff.
That's
know?
Where he got a chance to show off his stuff, and you could hear him in the mix, too.
Yeah, I mean, I like that because he was kind of drowned out after that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really like, I like Jason, too. I mean, he's a nice guy, too. And when I was in San Francisco at that 30th anniversary gig, he and I were standing up on the balcony and Ozzy was up there playing, and he had played with Ozzy, and he just hits me in the arm. He's like, how cool is this? I'm like, Ozzy right there, man. You know,
that's cool, man. Those guys give you that respect. How about Cliff? What was your favorite Cliff song?
Just watching him play Anesthesia. I mean, you know, he'd just go off on his own thing, and you know, he was in a different realm, you know. We never really heard anybody like that.
How about his playing on Kill 'Em All? Is it pretty much what you were doing, or did he just take it and make it completely his own?
No, he took it into a different level, though. You know, I was if you can listen to No Life Till Leather, then you can listen to Kill 'Em All, and you can tell the big difference, you know. But I mean, especially like, well, James's voice was way different, you know. But I mean, he just brought a heaviness and a thrashiness to him. And just watching him with that 3-foot hair, you know, just craziness.
Jean jacket, bell bottoms.
He just, it's like he walked right out of Lynyrd Skynyrd. I mean, that's exactly what he looked like.
Right. And that was his vibe, too, yeah. Right? As a player.
Yeah.
Ron, it's been great talking to you, man.
All right, Chris.
It's very, very cool. Thanks for coming.
Appreciate it.
Thanks to OG Metallica bassist Ron McGovney for sharing such killer stories about Metallica's formation, early days, and first gigs. And if it's live gigs you want to see, get on board the Chris Jericho Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea, setting sail October 27th. Still a few cabins left at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. You're going to get to see Fozzy, Corey Taylor, King, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons, The Stir, The Dave Spivak Project, Blizzard of Oz, Shoot to Thrill. All of these great rock and roll bands are all-inclusive when you book your cabin, along with all the live podcasts, comedy shows, meet and greets, autograph signings, and wrestling matches, and your food. All you got to pay for is alcohol and gambling. It's going to be so much fun. We do know for sure some of the matches. Ring of Honor versus Impact, as we have Sammy Callahan versus Marty Scurll kicking it off. The Alpha Club will be wrestling the Bucks of Jericho, or is it Y2 Jackson? We've got a live Talk is Jericho with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Another live Talk is Jericho remembering Eddie Guerrero with Conan and Rey Mysterio. Mick Foley is doing his 20 Years of Hell stand-up show. We also got a live Talk is Jericho with the entire Bullet Club. Another live Talk is Jericho with Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler. We've got the Words of Jericho, my one-man show. I'll be doing all these things for you. I'm actually marrying somebody as well. And the first round of the Ring of Honor, Sea of Honor tournament has been announced. Jay Lethal versus BJ Whitmer, Christopher Daniels versus Delirious, Marty Scurll versus Rhett Titus, Silas Young versus Flip Gordon, and we got the B bracket, Mark Briscoe versus Will Ferrara, Adam Page versus Frankie Kazarian, Cheeseburger versus Beer City Bruiser, Jay Briscoe versus Kenny King, plus we got the Keeping It 100 crew, Conan, Disco Inferno, Shane Helms versus Killing the Town, Don Callis, Paul Lazenby, and an unnamed third. So many other things going on. Brad Williams, Craig Gass, Ron Funches, Sal and Q from the Impractical Jokers, Colt Cabana, Marty DeRosa doing their Unprofessional Wrestling podcast. So much fun. So many great things. SoCal Val will be there. Noel Foley will be there. The Cherry Bombs will be there. It's going to be the vacation of a lifetime. Book your cabin now at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Come join the fun. Come make history. ChrisJerichoCruise.com. And speaking of history, coming up on Friday, it's Something to Jericho with Bruce Pritchard. That's right. Bruce Pritchard's got one of the hottest podcasts in the world today. Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard. Well, he's going to join me here on Talk is Jericho this Friday. So stay tuned for that. Until then, in the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. Search and seek and destroy.